know you're not used to seeing me in this format, but here we are in a video format with Fit and Revamp the podcast. And I'm so excited to be joined today by Miss Tiffany Bloom, the author of Pray Tell. Say hello to everyone.
Hey, so glad to be here.
Well, we are so excited to have you. With the recent launch of your newest book, we are excited to illuminate you and that book. So let's go ahead and have you share a little bit about who you are and what it is.
Yes, my name is Tiffany Bloom, as she said, and I am an author. I'm a speaker. I'm a writer. I write for the YouVersion Bible app. I've written books and Bible studies. I travel to speak to women, and I'm the co-host of the Why Though podcast with fellow author and friend Ashley Abercrombie.
Yes, I was able to take a look at that and I was like, how cool is that? So I actually kind of want to jump into that question before we segue into the rest of it. You also co-host. So what is that experience like for you versus writing, being in a live format?
Oh, man, I love it. Because writing is so insular. It's a very isolating experience, especially, you know, eventually you work with editors and copywriters and different and publicists and different things like that. But it's very much you, your research and your writing. And then to be able to co-host, you know, we always have each other to bounce off of. We've just started having guests more recently in the last couple of months. But for the last almost 3 years, it's just been the two of us talking about the news and what's going on in the world and systemic injustice and women's issues and you know, our favorite things. So it's been a joy. I've really enjoyed it because it's the one thing I do with somebody else.
That is awesome. Well, I'm definitely excited to highlight you and your newest accomplishment. So before we jump into that, I always like to ask our guests, how do you define freedom?
I love that question. I define freedom by not feeling constrained by anything exterior. Freedom is liberating. Freedom is something that we can walk in at the fullness of God, knowing that we aren't going to be constrained by everything outside of us, trying to tell us how to be, what to do, how to shape up, but knowing that because of, honestly, for me, because of knowing I am who I am, then I can walk in the freedom and knowing I'm responsible for my decisions, my choices. I don't have to be responsible for other people's. And they can't place that blame and shame on me. And I think as women, that's particularly difficult when we live in a society where we're often blamed when something goes wrong. We're seen as a scapegoat. So freedom means you are not free to place your expectations and your blame and shame on me.
I love that definition. That is so definitions that we've received in the past. I always end up changing my definition after hearing others because it just adds another little flavor. I'm like, oh, that's different. That's another perspective. That definitely contributed to my definition of freedom. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So our founder, Courtney, talks about freedom as a practice. So with that being said, how do you think you practice freedom on a daily or weekly basis?
I would say I would practice freedom by giving myself margin, because I think we start to feel indebted to those, to our calendar, to other people, to our to-do list, when we don't allow margin to simply be without doing. We're human beings, not human doing. So I would say the practicing freedom is time to do nothing. And for me, honestly, sometimes when I need to just like power down and practicing my freedom to just simply be without accomplishing anything, I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, so I love to achieve. But to simply be is freedom to me because I don't owe anybody anything. I don't have to meet anyone else's expectations. And so I don't even listen to music when I do that. I simply just sit with silence. Maybe I have a cup of coffee, decaf. I'm like straight decaf. I know. I'm like, it's so boring. But it really makes room for me to be who I need to be all the time when I'm free in that space. And I guard it like a hawk.
Oh, my God. I think that last part is the most important part, guarding it and protecting it. Yeah. Because too often we let the world and other people invade that space. And then it's like fighting for that space again. So you make a very great point with that.
Thank you.
All right, Tiffany, the time, and I am so excited to talk about this lovely gem here.
Oh, hey. So exciting. I love it. I love that little yellow cover.
Like, how cool is it to see this?
It's pretty wild.
Look at that. That's your name.
And it's so big. Cool. I didn't ask for that. I don't want you to think I asked for that. They did that all by themselves. I had nothing to do with that.
You know who wrote this. This is truly a gem.
There's no question there.
I love it. down to the formatting and everything. Like, this is a book that covers a very important topic in such an eloquent and receptive way that it's easy to, like, it's palatable. It doesn't hurt to taste this. This is a very good eat. Good eat. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So you are a writer. And I already told you earlier before we started this interview how I've already explored some of your other writing, your devotionals, specifically on the Bible YouVersion. So if anyone has the YouVersion Bible app and you've ever done any plans, type in Tiffany Bloom, and she has not just one, but several plans that you can start that are very fulfilling, specifically for women. I was able to look at some. There's one entitled She Dreams that's so important to me because I'm a dreamer. I'm an actor. So essentially, we're full of imagination and dreams, and that resonated with me specifically. So just to kind of bring that up, I want to know a little bit about what the dynamic is between writing a devotional and writing a book.
Yeah, I would say writing books, you have a lot more freedom for narrative. You have a lot more freedom to kind of shape the text as you want to prove your point. But when you're writing a devotional, there's already a main theme and a truth and a gospel that you have to mold and bend to versus you being able to kind of call the narrative. So I would say, and it requires a ton more research when you really want to ace biblical scholarly work. But it's just as fun. I think for me, one of the things that can... that is exciting about writing a devotional is it's a dialogue. You know, you're inviting people into the story of scripture versus just telling your story. And so making sure that they feel like there's entry points of where, how could they find themselves in this place? How could they find themselves in those shoes in a way that that captures their moment? Because you are quite literally setting people up to commune with the divine. And so it's so much different than just hoping that your idea or narrative comes across in story form, but like, I want you to meet Jesus when you read these words. So I would say it's a tall order, but one that I don't take lightly and one that I have very much enjoyed.
I love it. And I think the other really cool point that you guys have implemented in those devotionals is the video aspect. So it's like having your voice and also seeing you and these really cool elements, it adds to it. You have a spoken word that opens up the She Dreams devotional. And I was like, there's no way you can't finish this devotional. There's no way you don't want to just go day after day all in, like, you want to binge it. I know that's a crazy concept, like binging devotionals. They give you like these short excerpts and you're like, I want to just keep going. Cause it's just so good. It's so good.
That's certainly the hope.
Absolutely. It was definitely effective. So as we start to talk about the book, I want to know first how you jumped into the writing of this book. What led you to say, hey, this is a book that needs to be written. This is what I want to talk about. And essentially what led to the subject matter of the book.
Yeah. After my own experience of speaking truth to power and finding that I, as a woman, as an immigrant minority woman, was disposable, and the men in my world who abused their power were seen as indispensable, I myself was grappling with the financial, societal, spiritual, communal, and professional ramifications of speaking up. And I think for so many women, we stay silent to fit the cultural expectations people have on us. But when somebody's abused their power at our expense, we're often seen as the scapegoat, not the hero. We're told to stay in our place and to stay in our lane, and to our detriment. And so many women throughout history have experienced this. And we have moved that moral arc of the universe toward justice, but we have a long way to go when we think of how women have been subjugated, silenced, and slandered. In fact, when you think of the Industrial Revolution or globalization, you see how it's been predicated on the domination, dominion, and subjugation of women.
Definitely. So now that you've talked a little bit about how and to come to the writing of this book, what led to the title? Like, how did you decide on this title? Because I think the title itself is so telling. How did you decide on that?
Yeah. So my husband and I, we were tossing around ideas that had the word pray in it, P-R-A-Y. But then we were like, well, this is all about a woman who's been preyed upon, you know, and it's not just sexually. It's when somebody is preying upon your time, your space, your loyalty, your reputation, and your body. And so thinking about all of those things and how you've the pray, and that P-R-A-Y-T-E-L-L means pray tell, to tell the story, tell me more. And so the idea of the prey, the one who's been hunted to tell the story, it versus the dominant narrative, the male narrative telling a story, we thought was pretty clever. So I remember he was standing in our kitchen. He's like, pray tell, P-R-E-Y. And I was like, oh, that's it. That's it. That nails it. It tells so much, and just, it almost sounds like a fiction title because it just, it tells so much and gets the glands salivating without knowing exactly where it's going.
Definitely. I think there is a little bit of irony to it. It's like, what am I getting ready to read?
Exactly. It's intentional for sure.
This is good. Like, this is really clever. And like, when you understand the subject matter, it's like, that's so telling to what it is or what I would assume you were going for when writing this book. Yeah. So I am super excited to ask you a little bit about the formatting of the book before we get into the topic of it. The formatting of the book was something that was so special to me. Like, so you have, of course, these parts. You've got these three main parts. And then aside from the three, well, let's name those three parts really quick for everyone. So the parts of the book are entitled Why We Silence Women Who Tell the Truth, How We Silence Women, and How Everyone Can Speak Up. Part three was so important to me because it brings in the concept of like creating allyship for these people who are prey, right?
That's right.
So there's how does everyone get to speak up? And you very clearly tap into every area of these victims of sexual harassment and abuse and assault in a way in which we can understand that everyone has a part in making the change. You don't put all the effort and all of the task on the prey. You give it to everyone. Everyone has a space they need to perform. And then underneath those parts, each chapter is so lovely. And then there's subtitles in between those. So how did you come to formatting this book in a way that was, it flows so beautifully for the reader?
Oh, thank you so much. I want to say that this was a lot of work. My agent and I, we kept going back of like, should it be like death, burial, resurrection? Because that's kind of the path that follows of like, women are death by, you know, we experience these death by a thousand cuts, and we often set ourselves on fire to keep other people warm. And in reality, this is not the intent. This is not how women thrive in the world. So the idea of why we silence women, I had to start there because I think we see something on CNN or BBC News or Christianity Today, and we're like, how did this happen? Why didn't anybody speak up? Why didn't she say something? Why didn't the board members know? Or why didn't other people know? Or how did this happen for so long? When we find out misconduct or some sort of scandal where a woman's been objectified. And the reality is, there are systems in place that keep that going, and there's psychology that we're all living and leaning into that enables complicit behavior, because we're either complicit or we're advocates. There's no in between here. And so I wanted to answer the behind the scenes question. Why did these things happen in the first place? Why, when we hear of Bill and Monica Lewinsky, we've let Bill have a free pass and he's, you know, doing speaking engagements and charging $1 million a keynote, yet Monica Lewinsky for 20 years couldn't get a job. Like, why is that? So I wanted to be able to peel back the layers and examine why we penalize women and why we forgive men so easily. And then, of course, how we do it, the practicality. Is it payoffs? Is it NDAs? Is it, you know, public pressure, peer pressure, you know, fear of your reputation being ruined? How exactly do we systematically destroy women's lives, and how do we contribute to those systems? And then, of course, just as you said, the practical ways that we can speak up, the practical ways that we can see that our silence is demanding nothing of us, and it can lead to violence, and it can lead to subjugation. And then, of course, how we can all make a difference.
Absolutely. I think the one thing that comes to mind when you mentioned the way in which media shines a light on these issues, it does make it almost seem as if the woman is subject to all of the task in the situation. You said, why didn't she say anything? What took her to say anything? Or why did she put up with it? Or why didn't she mention it to anyone in the space, or whether it was a relationship, familial or domestic, whatever the case may be, it usually is put on the woman. Mm-hmm. And most recently in media, the past years, we've seen movement rise. And that is one thing mm-hmm. that you mentioned in the book that I want to kind of talk about, because you make very solid commentary on the Me Too movement. And I just want to know how effective you thought it was getting to a place of resolve for some of these issues, or evoking some resolve in regards to these issues.
Evoking emotion, evoking activism, yes. Resolve, not necessarily. I mean, we have to recognize that there's still no legislation, bylaws, or policies up for vote that would enact any of the Me Too changes that we want to see as women in the workplace and places we worship. We are still have yet to see those. And so it also is this reminder that it's going to take a grassroots effort. This isn't a moment. As we know, this is a movement. And when we look at history, especially in the last 100 years, for women's rights and a woman's place in the world, it will take time and it will take continually pushing the line toward justice, because the powerful have something to gain when women lose. There's somebody with an agenda here, and it's the powerful versus the powerless. And I think when I look at how women are treated, and if you look at minority women especially and immigrant women especially, there is a unique harm caused, and there's stereotypes that are played into this, you know, whether they're hypersexual or subservient or whatever the case may be, how that is that keeps this issue from gaining traction, because we're believing myths and stereotypes about women rather than believing that we need to demand equitable spaces for all women. There's a lot of people doing a lot of good work, but the fact remains there is no legislation and policies that would put a lot of this into place. So it truly is on all of us to have an interior change of heart and change of posture, as well as an exterior communal response.
Absolutely, because I think the biggest issue is that all of the things that are happening and the negative effects are coming and stemming from patriarchy.
That's right.
So patriarchy is the overarching thing. And then from that, all these other are trickling from it, to the point where we did have to even have a Me Too movement, because there's so many people experiencing this in so many different areas of life. So I think that that is probably the most disheartening. And you talk specifically about the power dynamics between women and men, and what those have normalized behavior. There's certain behavior that has become normalized. So based on those power dynamics, how do you think that women can work toward a place of being able to advocate for ourselves in these negative spaces, these spaces that often evoke like fear and trauma for us?
I first want to just say that I love that you included that they evoke fear and trauma. It's just so wise that, I mean, as women, of course we know this, right? Like, this is a no-brainer for us. And I was on an interview with a gentleman interviewing me, a white man, resourced man. And he said, well, you know, now do men need to have fear that they're gonna like mess up or false allegations? And I said, instead of that fear response, perhaps put yourself in our shoes. When you close Absolutely. The door behind us to have a meeting and we're trapped in there with you, or perhaps consider your physical size. Consider your platform, consider your reputation, consider who would be believed, consider how you might come across when you touch our back or our shoulder, consider what we're feeling. And he was like, oh, thank you for that. I didn't think of it like that. I'm so sorry. You know, that remembering that the sign of fear is the absence of safety and sound mind and love and joy and equity. And so when we back up the things to notice, how do we advocate for ourselves in these many injustices is first to recognize those power dynamics, right? As I just mentioned them, but physical size, class, gender, obviously that we're talking about men and women, reputation, resources, power. When we take into consider those power dynamics, before things even go poorly, we can advocate for there to be balanced spaces where our voice is heard, because often women want to honor the gatekeepers who led them in the room. If it's a man, if it's a resource man, we want to honor that man who's led us in there, especially if he holds the purse strings to our paycheck. We feel like there's a debt to pay there. But in reality, Absolutely. That's exactly what keeps us in this silo of feeling silenced, feeling like we have to meet the expectations that are set around us that are normalized, especially if, you know, we're in an office or the places we work or worship, you know, coarse joking is acceptable, or inappropriate touching, or candor in the name of offense. Like, I mean, without care to offense, somebody's getting offended and nobody seems to care that that's okay. I think being able to see, like, do I want to, like, is this a safe space? And there's a lot of privilege in that question, because some of us, we don't get to decide if we get to stay or not, because we got to feed our babies and we got to pay them bills. So there's a lot to it when we think about how do we advocate. But I think when we advocate, it can look like, can more women be in places of power here? Because research shows when more women have power, not one performative nature, one woman in power, but when many women have power, it is more likely that there will be enacted policies, bylaws, procedures in place that will benefit all women and men. So I think that's one way, is having women in power, because not only situations where a woman can be advocated for or heard or seen, not diminished, like, you know, told she's too emotional or too angry or too bossy, or when she's being rigid, but in reality, she's just having healthy boundaries. We've got to have more women in power who are making those decisions and who are on the other side of the table. And I think in addition to that, another way we can really advocate is anonymous reporting systems. And this can be in any job. I don't care if it's a fast food restaurant, corporate America, Walmart, wherever you are. So many women do not come forward because they fear retribution. I mean, in my own experience, I knew I would be annihilated for speaking up against a superior. And I was. And I lost a lot in that process. I was the breadwinner for my home. I mean, you know, we live in a world where our healthcare is attached to our job. I was my healthcare. I mean, there's so much to lose. But being able to have anonymous structures can give some courage, can feel like the weak will be protected. Those who are advocating will have legs to stand on where they won't face unnecessary backlash. And those who they have accusations against, or those who they need to bring up issues with, they can be seen and heard for what it is without fearing retribution of any kind. So I think more women in power, that's what we can advocate for. Anonymous reporting systems, we can advocate for that. And just equitable spaces and being able to name what those are. It can be something as simple as more women in the room, obviously, as we just talked about, but not feeling like you need to be alone with somebody you don't want to be alone with, not, you know, of what's appropriate that men can say to women. I think we normalize joking or offhanded comments or talking about women in a derogatory way, even if it's has nothing to do with sexualizing her appearance or her aptitude, but just talking about her in a derogatory way. We have so become accustomed to that. And I think a part of that, honestly, is how fraternity culture has seeped into adult life, because often when fraternity culture, guys are taking advantage of their position, women are being objectified, often institutions, educational institutions, they won't go to bat for women because they don't want their institution to look bad. They don't want the word to get out because then they're going to lose donor dollars. They're going to lose their reputation. And so when we let men get away with things in middle school and high school and fraternity life, and then they are fully formed adults who maybe perhaps aren't in touch with their emotions, they're not emotionally healthy, they're not given proper examples and interactions with women that are honoring in just human dignifying experiences. And then what do? We have that imbalance in nearly every sector of society, church, education, entertainment, business, politics, what have you.
Definitely. I mentioned earlier that I'm an actor, so that's a big thing. It's an underlying thing that comes up all the time, that feeling of like fear and trauma, like, to be in these rooms with these directors or with fellow co-stars or whatever the case may be, and not feel comfortable because of things that you've heard or things that have been rumored about the industry. It's such a very real experience. So going back and talking about fear and trauma, to kind of intersect what we do here at Freedom Revamped with what you talk about in your book, I want to know how you feel about sexual harassment, abuse, assault, and how the fear and trauma attached to that, how that essentially kind of strips us of our freedom.
Yeah. I think something that we forget is that physiology and psychology and experience, all those wires get crossed, right? Our body quite literally keeps the score of our experiences, our mind, our spirit, our heart rate. They're all affected when we go through something terrifying. And I quote Columbia research professor Michael Slepian, and I believe it's like chapter 2 or 3, talking about how we don't keep secrets in silence. Silence and secrets keep us. They keep us chained and bound, because we often will act as if staying silent from our trauma will be an act of self-preservation. And in reality, we are halting ourselves from getting the societal sympathy and empathy and healing that we require to be a whole, thriving woman in the world. And so I think that when we think of the trauma that we experience, many of us, you know, research shows that most women don't come till their late 30s, early 40s, can grapple with their experience and realize what happened actually happened. Because we don't want to admit that we put ourselves in harm's way, because we must have done something to deserve it. And unfortunately, Bible scripture has been weaponized to agree with that. And of course, society, rape culture and purity culture, they ask the same question. What did you do? What were you wearing? Where were you? How much did you drink? We ask all these questions as if the onus is on women to abuse, avoid abusive power more than it's on men to behave justly. And I think your example of the entertainment industry is the perfect example, because here were these women who wanted to thrive in their career. They had incredible aspirations, and that they were good. It wasn't greedy or self-fulfilling in any way that was inappropriate. But Weinstein, he weaponized Gwyneth Paltrow's trajectory and her star-studded IMDb against these women, saying, "Well, I did that for her. Look what I could do for you if you let me do this to you." Like, just this twisted understanding of what a woman must do to thrive in the world. And it is assaulting. As we said, it's assaulting on our body, but on our mind and on our heart and on our spirit in a way that is so damaging that sometimes we don't even understand, because it's so normalized. It's so normalized. So I think being able to see that, although assault and trauma, and I want to say quickly that I think that it's so important to remember the vernacular that we're even talking about, sexism and misogyny and patriarchy and especially sexual harassment and assault. This common vernacular that we often talk about in the year 2021 of our Lord wasn't common vernacular until the late 60s, early 70s. And we can thank Ruth Bader Ginsburg a lot for that, putting this common vernacular into our language, everyday language. And so now women have the words to describe their experience. We have the words to describe how they have been harmed. And I think the more that we can arm women with the vocabulary to describe their experiences, the better. Because as we understand, because when you can't name something, when you can't name a trauma, it's very difficult to find healing for that trauma. But as we begin to name it, as we begin to understand how it's affected us, we can then seek that healing. And I think that whether it is at the hands of the workplace, whether it's at the hands of a spouse, whether it's at the hands of a partner, whether it's at the hands of some a place you, a house of worship, whatever the case may be, understanding that it is not your job to bear somebody else's shame. But that's what victim blaming does, right? It makes us feel like we did something to deserve this. And we ask those leading questions, assuming that in our right mind, we would have reacted differently. We would have handled it differently. And even that is an act of self-preservation called the just world hypothesis, meaning that somebody must have done something for something bad to happen to them. They somehow must have deserved it. Because if not, if they fell prey, then so could I. I could easily be targeted. I could easily have my world shook without any objection. And so seeking that wholeness, seeking that healing, we have to, as society, we have got to stop giving empathy to the perpetrator. Because why do we do that? We see how he is sorrowful out in public after the fact, because the trauma has happened in the past to these victims that we might not be intimately aware of what happened. But then our empathy is called upon by somebody who's been grooming, whether it's culture at large, if they're a beloved icon, or whether it's in a church, or whether it's in a business, what have you. But they've likely groomed everyone around to feel sorry for them and to offer that empathy. And research shows even other women who hear about a situation are more likely to offer empathy to a man who has abused his power than a woman who didn't deserve her misconduct.
I think that's super disheartening, because it's not an unfamiliar occurrence. This is something that, unfortunately, too many of us have to say, me too. That's why this whole movement, because we've all experienced it, the abuse of power, or the disregard for care for the feelings of others, specifically this arena that we're talking about. So I think for me, when you brought up the mention of like the weaponizing of the word, this is a conversation that I've had with friends and with colleagues in regards to the word. It's a male-dominated book. So it's so easy for the patriarchy to take something that is kind of written within a male, from a male's lens, and say, yeah, oh, well, this is what they meant, or this is what they meant. And for everyone to say, you're right. Or for everyone to not question. And that's the part that's most frightening, because you're talking about people who are religious figures, who are telling people these things that are all essentially making us as women shrink. So that was the next question that I did want to ask, because there's a specific moment in the book that you talk about the misuse of Matthew 18. Yeah. It's one of the subsections. And immediately I got excited because I had just talked to a friend about my experience with having read the word from cover to cover and being like, it kind of sucks that there's not more women present. And I know that women were there because there's no way these men would have existed without these women. And then hearing the one story, like the stories that did come up, I was like, these stories, but at the end of the day, we were in relation to men. All of these stories were in relation to men. And it kind of was disheartening. I was like, I don't want to believe that is the way in which God wants us to see ourselves as subject to men. There is this whole idea of like us being submissive and things like that gets misused and abused. Oh my gosh, like that's the most misused and abused portion of the Bible. Like that's submit right. to men. And that's not the context in which it's written. And
yeah, that's domestic violence.
And being able to open it up and see the context, it's like, that's not what was being said. But we don't know that if we don't question, if we don't ask. And we're often taught in religion too, not to question or ask. So I do want to talk to you a little bit about that and have you expound on that, because I want to know, what are your feelings about that dynamic and how that affects us as Christian women?
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I'm like, I'm going to let you have this answer because you just nailed it. But I will expound. I think first, we have to remember, you said this so perfectly, this was written through a male lens, And when we see Genesis 1, we see equality. We see mutuality. We see reciprocity. And it was only after the fall that men were lording over women and women were trying to usurp. So you see this broken, fractured vision of what happened when sin came into the world. Now let's fast forward, and we have plenty of Old Testament examples of what not to do and how not to treat women, but we hold those up as how we should do things. And in reality, we're seeing how women were treated and how Jesus had to come to make everything right because of how women were treated. Obviously that is part of how he came and why he came. But then you look at the first century and you look at how the Greco-Roman influence of the first century that believed that women were deformed men, women were inherently untrustworthy, women were the presence of evil in the world. Those beliefs infiltrated the church, and the early church fathers, they really got on board with that, which is just their own sin nature, got on board with that when Jesus came to bring equality of the sexes. Whew. And so then in their writing, in the future, you see how that plays out. And then you think of the time of the printing press, and how that advent brought such dissemination of that, dare I say, propaganda of treating women as second. And so you have constantly in these positions in scripture where women were treated as second, and women were enslaved to their husbands, enslaved to their fathers, terrifying situations. But when Jesus comes on the scene, we must take the whole life of Jesus over a few passages in the Old Testament. The whole life of Jesus emboldens, unleashes, empowers women as equals, as complete equals. It is, when you look at Jesus' encounter with women in the New Testament, game over, man, game over. He protected their body. He protected their reputation. He protected their home. He helped them financially get set up. I mean, it is beautiful. It's just dripping with goodness. And for me, that is my true north. When I look at Jesus and how he treated women, I have my marching orders. But as men have taught the scriptures over time, and even with certain translations, they have worded it in such a way that would lead us to believe that women, they don't deserve equality or reciprocity, that they don't have a place of leadership, that they are not to occupy places of power. But nothing could be further from the truth, especially when we look at Jesus.
Absolutely. So my favorite part about the book is that you're talking about a very worldly issue here, right? But you are finding ways in which you connect it to this ever-changing word. I talk about the word, it's referred to as a living word. And it really does connect to all of the things that we're dealing and battling with today. So I wanted to kind of point to that, because you reference it so much. Is that a commentary that like the word and God is giving us the direct answer to how to solve these issues, or that he is giving us guidance on how to handle these things and the effects of sexual assault, abuse, and harassment?
Yeah, I think the greatest example of that, I absolutely 100% believe that that's my hope of this, and that's what I truly believe is our marching orders. And I think we have so many great examples, but two that I want to just quickly bring up. Number one, when we see in the Gospels where Jesus is trapped by the Pharisees, those who were living by the letter of the law. They didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, and that they bring out a woman who has been supposedly caught in adultery. And they said, oh, who should cast the first stone? You know, the law says she should be murdered for sleeping with somebody who wasn't her husband. And he does not even answer all that. He immediately goes to protect her physical body. Protect her physical body. He places himself in between those who would cast the first stone and this woman. And then he deals with them. He writes down on the ground. And then who among you is without sin that can cast the first stone? And only after they've left, we just so easily look over this little detail. Once they had gone, then he had a dignified conversation with her, saying, go and sin no more. He didn't shame her. He didn't read the list of everything she might have could or might have not done. He simply said, go. That reputation restoration is just so powerful to me. He made no assumptions. He just said, go. Go and sin no more. Go live your life, sister. And then another passage, you know, after Jesus died and resurrected, we see that Mary Magdalene was the first to the tomb and it's empty. And she's thinking, this body, this dead body's been stolen. And then she goes and gets the disciples and they come back, two of the disciples. And they're like, yeah, he's gone. And then they leave again. And she still stays. And Jesus revealed himself only after the men had left. He could have revealed himself when those two disciples were in there, but nope. He waited till the men had left. He was intentionally revealing himself to Mary Magdalene. I mean, we're talking about the first century. Women had no weight of testimony when they testified in court. It was believed that there was fear of punishment or they would only live for personal gain. They were inherently untrustworthy. Yet the entire message of the resurrection rested on a woman's shoulders. I mean, you can take that to the bank and cash it. I don't care what anybody can say, because that right there, my friend, gives us such clear proof of what Jesus believes of women. That is the word progressive doesn't even work for it. That is so countercultural. That is so upside down to culture that I'm going to leave everything on the weight of a woman's shoulders because she can handle it. I mean, that just, it speaks volumes.
Absolutely. Isn't it crazy that the greatest man to walk the earth trusted us more than the earth today?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And that idea of believe women, right? The Me Too movement's anthem is believe women. And what did Jesus to advance the message of the resurrection of new life that he was the Messiah was to believe a woman. Just, we have a clear understanding of what it takes to empower women.
Absolutely. And I think the biggest part that brings it all home for me, and you just opened my eyes to this too, is the New Testament depiction of women in relation to Christ and the way in which he treats them, or the way they are kind of magnified in the New Testament. Even though their stories are not gone into detail, there is very special treatment of these women who are seeking restoration from him, or who are not even seeking anything, just were coming to magnify him themselves, and the treatment of others toward them and how God negated those. And I just think that overall, I'm so excited about what this book is going to do, because it's going to not only bring up questions, like they always talk about table talk. Not only is it going to generate table talk, it's going to effectively be able to make change with God as the guide. Because you have very clear that are guiding it. So those are your words. You allow God to use you as a vessel to put together a piece that is, like I said, palatable. This is something that I can read as a woman who has been a victim of sexual assault and harassment. And I can also give to someone else who might be trying to advocate for women who have dealt with these issues. Or I can give to someone else who is curious about how to be an ally for women who have dealt with these issues. And I can give to someone who might be a predator of women who are dealing with these issues. And they can look at it and effectively examine themselves and the choices and the behaviors that they normalized and reshape themselves. Yeah. And then in reshaping themselves, one better person can help to better another person, which is a better society. So this is one splash in a pond that is going to truly shake things up. And I just want to thank you, one, for writing it and being obedient to God and doing so. And two, for joining us here on the Freedom Revamp podcast in the video format. We're so excited to have you again, like I said, and this conversation has truly been fulfilling. I can't express to you how excited I am. Like, I really wish the conference and we could just sit here and talk forever because I love this topic.
Yes. My friends always let's make it happen. 2022 is around the corner. We got this.
So excited. Oh, absolutely. Let me know when it's coming because I'm going to be there. But I absolutely love the, and I am encouraging all of our listeners and our viewers in this case to get out and get you one. And let me tell you something. Tiffany has it all centralized for you. Visit tiffanybloom.com. And not only can you purchase this book, you can purchase her other previous books, find access to what she has coming up next. You can also visit the YouVersion Bible app and start some of her plans. She's got great plans that are going to help to, they're weekly plans. So it's a short week plan that will definitely start to ignite something different in you, whether you are familiar with Christ or you are not familiar with Christ, wherever you are at in your walk. I definitely feel like Tiffany has a voice that is easy to be heard, and that is something that I encourage you to listen to. So thank you again, Tiffany, for joining us. You have truly been a pleasure. Can you please share with everyone a little bit more about how they can find you, where they can find you, and where they can get your latest book?
Yeah, well, you can find links to all major and indie retailers at tiffanybloom.com, as well as book club discussion guides and the book trailer, as well as you can read the first chapter for free or listen to the first chapter for free, all at tiffanybloom.com. And for the everyday, I'm mostly on Instagram at tiffanybloom.
Awesome. So definitely make sure that you all give her a follow. Continue to rewatch this video because I'm sure you missed something that you need to go back and listen to, because she dropped a million gems in this video. She spoke so eloquently about the topic of sexual harassment, assault, and abuse. And I think that I know I've grown through this conversation. I'm sure you will as well. So as always, remember to continue to practice freedom, and thank you for watching.